Well, from an iconic chip-in of yesteryear to a nine-iron laser that flipped the script on Sunday, we have you covered with great golf shots here on the newest episode of Musings on Golf. Hello, once again, I'm Kelly Elpin. My co-host and good friend Bob Bupka is off this week, but we are on point as we talk with the terrific author Chris Millard about his new book, The Shot, Watson, Nicklaus, Pebble Beach, and the Chip That Changed Everything. We'll also delve into the ramifications of Keegan Bradley's stunning victory over Tommy Fleetwood at the Travelers Championship outside of Hartford on Sunday. Okay, first, The Shot. You know, in my lifetime, there are two specific shots that stand above all others. Whether you put Tom Watson's chip in at one or 1A with Tiger's ridiculously praised chip from off the green at 16 that eventually propelled him to win the Masters in 2005. Those are arguments that can be had, but Watson's had so much to it. First of all, it was the National Open that Tom Watson knew growing up. His dad, Ray, was all about the history of what he called the National Open, the National Championship, as a lot of people did in those years. But Tom had not been able to win the U.S. Open. Jack Nicklaus, on the other hand, by the time the U.S. Open rolled around at Pebble Beach in 1982, had won four times and was on the precipice of becoming the only player to win the U.S. Open five times. In fact, when he parred 18, Jack, he was tied with Watson, and it looked for really to all the world that he was going to win, particularly when Watson's two iron sailed a little bit left and of the pin, maybe, I don't know, 20, 25 feet, really difficult pitch shot. Well, the rest is history. He made it and set off a firestorm of change, if you will, because that got Watson over the hump. And for Tom, it was personal, in addition to something that he had, you know, always wanted to do in terms of winning the national championship. But he also he played golf and went to school at Stanford University. So he played a lot of golf at Pebble Beach. He knew the golf course extremely well. And he finally, as I said earlier, he finally got over that hump. What I really love about Chris Millard's book, The Shot, and by the way, Chris worked for 3 years as Jack Nicklaus's communications director. Chris, extensive writer for a Golf World magazine, Golf Magazine, just a terrific author. He actually wrote a book with Jack about golf course design and architecture. So he knows the game and the history extremely well. And he just didn't write about this one particular shot of Watson's at the 82 U.S. Open. He wrote about the history of Pebble Beach. He wrote about the fact that, you know, age-wise, these two guys, Tom was really ascending. And for Jack, even though, yes, he went on and won the 86 Masters in grand fashion, it was, you know, towards the twilight of his career. So he talked a lot about the relationship that Watson had with Bruce Edwards, his caddy, who unfortunately came down with Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and passed far too soon. And I really enjoyed the history of Pebble Beach that Chris Millard conveyed in a way that I really didn't know all that much about. And a lot of twists and turns to that property. Them securing the 1929 U.S. Amateur really changed Pebble Beach because it pushed the United States Golf Association west in their championships. They had really played the U.S. Amateur and frankly, most of the U.S. Opens in the northeastern U.S. area. And they had played some in the central part of the country, but it was a real sea change to go out west, and Pebble Beach delivered. And then, of course, all the years with the Bing Crosby Pro-Am, the Crosby Clam Bake that annually put, you know, Pebble Beach on the map and with the celebrities and so forth. But I think that this is a book I enjoyed reading immensely. Again, anytime you have a book that is extremely well researched and written about something that you're passionate about, you're going to enjoy. The one other thing about this book that I didn't anticipate, and you'll hear from Chris, is that this was a real change for something that today we don't even think about as viewers of golf, and that is the Friday and Saturday or the Thursday and Friday coverage. Back in 1982, when ABC was dominant, I mean, ABC had the rights to the US Open, the British Open slash Open Championship, and the PGA Championship. And they owned TV. They decided to go with Thursday and Friday to actually show those two rounds for the first time because this fledgling cable network called ESPN got in touch with them and said, "Man, we'd love to be able to show some of that programming on Thursday and Friday." And they ended up doing that. And as it turned out, over the long haul, that began the change, the radical change, certainly for ABC's dominance in broadcasting, to ESPN playing a much larger role and ABC a much smaller role in golf broadcasting and cable over the years. Well, again, please enjoy this interview, and I hope you go out and buy the book, The Shot. It's absolutely terrific, extremely well researched. You're going to enjoy hearing from Chris Millard, having to do with The Shot, Watson, Nicklaus, Pebble Beach, and the chip that changed everything. Right after this, from our great partners, William and Harry and Titleist. William and Harry has entered a bold new era, led by their new Lionhead logo, a symbol of strength, leadership, and fearless ambition. Step onto the course with purpose, outplay the field, and dominate your opponent, while wearing handcrafted shoes that blend performance, luxury, and unmistakable style. William and Harry offers custom designs featuring your club, company, or organization's logo, so you stand out with every step. Visit williamandharry.com and use code 15OFFMOG for 15% off. William and Harry, walk with the lion.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee, more control with your irons, more spin with the wedges, and more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Just a shot of his that he generally plays very well. Of course, the conditions now that he has to play the shot test anyone, so we'll just have to see. Looks good.
Done.
Looks good. Do you believe it?
What can you say? Tom Watson pitching into the hole for a birdie has taken the lead in the U.S. Open. One more par, and he's finally won it.
Well, if you were watching golf in the 1980s, you fondly recall the lead ABC sports team of Jim McKay and Dave Marr, this time calling one of the most famous shots in the history of our game, Tom Watson's pitch-in from just off the green at the 17th hole at Pebble Beach Golf Links to effectively beat Jack Nicklaus and win the 1982 U.S. Open. Our guest today takes us back to that moment with a terrific new book entitled The Shot, Watson, Nicklaus, Pebble Beach, and the Chip That Changed Everything. Chris Millard is a New York Times bestselling author who has covered golf as an editor and columnist at Golf World Magazine and as an executive editor at Golf Magazine Properties. Chris Millard, the book is awesome. Welcome to Musings on Golf. Really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, thank you for having me, Kelly. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. One of the things that I love about this book is the whole context that you put it in, Chris. But before we get deep into that, what inspired you? Why this book at this time, about this particular shot, this moment in time, if you will?
Well, I had actually written a story for Golf World magazine years ago, about this shot, about the chip. And very often a magazine article spurs a book or something broader. And so I'd written that article and I knew there was more to it. The idea of putting it in context in terms of development of Pebble, Watson's career, golf television, these things all started piling up, and I thought, wow, there might be a book here. And then, independent of that, Golf Channel and ESPN on their own, over time, did rankings of the greatest shots in golf history. And they each independently came to the conclusion that that was the best shot in golf history. So that kind of confirmed, it kind of validated this idea. And that's what inspired me to write the book.
Did they put them that shot rank it ahead of Tiger's chip in at the Masters?
So that was what, 05?
Five, yeah.
So I think some of those rankings actually came out before that. I think some of
Right.
these rankings that I looked at were more in the early 2000s, late 90s.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, because I think for a lot of us who've watched golf through the years, you put those, I do at least, I put those two shots right about at the same level for the significance. And the moment and the historical
That's the key. You're
right?
what you're touching on is the context of the actual shot, how important the shot was, how important the event was, where
Yeah.
it happened in the event. But for me, it's a little hard. It was hard for me to get over. I had to make a leap on this book, and that was I have a hard time listing a chip shot as a incredible shot. But typically a chip just isn't as stunning as a 192 yard 2 iron. But given the moment, given the status of the tournament, given how important, how it changed things, then I made the leap.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, we've already used the word context a few times, and I think it's important because in the book, you talk about the history of Pebble Beach golf links. You talk about what up to that point, Watson's inability to actually win the U.S. Open, right? And another area that really, Chris, was a tremendous sea change from the over-the-air TV that we used, we knew in golf coverage for years, to cable. So maybe start there with 1982. It really was a landmark for that kind of coverage, and it's today something we just take for granted.
That's exactly right. And in fact, if you go back, Kelly, back into the early days of golf television, really, which started in the late 40s, no one had TV, so no one watched it. But golf television really got its groove in the 1950s and early 60s. Back then, they were showing, the last three or four holes. It was like a moon launch to even air a golf tournament because let's just take baseball. Baseball was pretty easy to air because every field is exactly the same dimensions. There's the foul lines, the mound, the bases. And if you know where to put your cameras, you're done. You can capture all the action. Golf, I mean, it's over 200 acres, 300 acres, 150 guys or 72 guys, depending on the weekend or not. Weather, hills, trees, it's so difficult. And so the ability to broadcast many, many holes, like an entire back nine or eventually even an entire 18, was very slow developing. The equipment got a lot lighter. Back in these early days of golf television, the cameras alone were like as heavy as a car. So there was no mobility. And so as the technology improved and as the ability to cover more ground and more shots improved, the window for golf television started to open a little bit. And really, Pebble affected that in two ways. It sped it up in two ways. One is Terry Jastrow and the team at ABC Sports. And if you and I know that back in the day, well, first of all, there were only three networks. Back when we were growing up, there were three networks. So everybody saw everything together. We weren't as fractured as we are today. And, so Jastrow and his team essentially said, wow, we have this incredible canvas of Pebble Beach that we're going to be showing. Why don't we show more of it? Why are we limiting ourselves to just a few holes? So they made that argument successfully within ABC Sports, and they actually pulled a little bit of time off of their big hit television show, which was Wide World of Sports. They basically took some time from Wide World and built that into the telecast, and that allowed them to show more holes. But the dynamic that we get to pretty deeply in the book is that as of 82, when ABC was this titan of televised sports, we were really still only showing golf on Saturdays and Sundays. and this little cable startup that no one really had ever heard of then, called ESPN, comes knocking on ABC's door and says, "Hey, we're looking for programming. Those Thursday and Friday rounds that you never show, why don't we air those on our little cable contraption?" And that began sort of this change, this massive change from broadcast domination of televised sports into cable getting its foot in the door, and slowly that ship turned. And amazingly enough, 20 years later or so, maybe not even 20, 10 years later or so, ESPN actually buys ABC.
That's right.
So the, the prey ate the predator.
Well, and you can't talk too much about how you mentioned the word Titan, how big ABC Sports was, Chris, at that time. They had the rights to the US Open, to the British Open, which everybody calls the Open Championship now, and the PGA Championship. And they had those rights for years. You had Monday Night Football with Rune Arledge running that show. My God, man, they were everything for televised sports for a very long time. And then the golf became a bigger and bigger component of the whole sports scene
Yeah.
for them.
And golf became huge because Rune Arledge loved golf. And, he used to play in the Pebble Beach Pro-Am all the time. And, he was the one when Rune Arledge got this. I mean, when Terry Jastrow, who was sort of the producer, and of course, Rune Arledge is the network exec. When the producer got the idea of, you know what, maybe we should do more of this Pebble Beach US Open, it was an easy sell because Rune Arledge loved Pebble. I mean, it was literally like a phone call, and Runaro says, "Yeah, more Pebble, great, let's do
Let's do it. Absolutely.
it."
Okay, so let's talk about Pebble Beach. So many twists and turns to the creation of Pebble Beach, the ownership of Pebble Beach, etc. I'm interested in particular the U.S. Amateur, which for many, many years, Chris, as you know, was almost bigger than the U.S. Open. The U.S. Amateur was played. It was basically a northeastern U.S. affair for many, many years, and finally, in 1929, Pebble Beach landed. The U.S. Amateur was played there, and Bobby Jones played, etc. What if you could speak a little bit about, just from a standpoint of the extension of golf across the country, what that event meant, not only for golf, but in particular for Pebble Beach to host the 29 Amateur?
Yeah, that was a huge leap, and it really revealed the USGA's ambitions. Not only was golf and the amateur concentrated in the Northeast, but much of America, much of our population was concentrated in the Northeast in 1929. And going to Pebble Beach, the San Francisco area, for a US Amateur Championship was pretty bold. But it kind of suggested that the USGA had massive ambitions and that they were going to essentially ignite the entire nation with golf for the long term. Now, the only problem was that Pebble really wasn't ready for a tournament of that significance. And so they had to essentially redo the golf course. And as we point out in the book, there were a lot of tribulations with Pebble Beach getting up to speed, becoming a world-class golf course. In fact, for much of its early life, it could barely impress the California Golf Association. The early founders there, all they wanted to do was become the go-to golf course for the California Golf Association. And every time they'd host an event, the CGA would come back and complain about this hole or complain about that hole. In fact, amazingly enough, as hard as it is to believe, one of their big complaints was the 18th hole at Pebble Beach, which ended up getting resolved. And it's one of the reasons we're even talking about Pebble today, is that the 18th hole became what it is. But they basically, for the 29-am, they had to spiff the place up. They had to make it a little bit tougher. And they brought in Chandler Egan, who is kind of a little bit overlooked and a little bit forgotten now. And Chandler Egan really, he was a great amateur. He might have been, in the early 1900s, he was probably in the top seven or eight amateurs in the entire country. NCAA champion, multiple US amateur champion, multiple regional amateur, state amateur champion. And he comes out and fixes up Pebble. And really, it was that redo of Pebble, in which he says he made the golf course maybe one or two shots harder, that really put Pebble on the map. That was the beginning of making Pebble the great and difficult test that it is. And so Chandler, a lot of the credit kind of rolls right off his back, but he deserves a lot of credit for that golf course.
All right, a lot of credit to Mr. Egan, and then of course Bing Crosby with the Crosby clam bake all through those years, and seeing Pebble Beach, every winter when much of the nation is cold, and you're seeing the fun that the celebrities are having out there. It continued and rose the prominence of Pebble Beach. Obviously, 72, you had the U.S. Open, and so pleased to be joined by the terrific author Chris Millard, whose new book, The Shot, chronicles the events of and around Tom Watson's famous chip in at the 1982 U.S. Open to win his first and only U.S. Open and effectively shut out Jack Nicklaus from becoming the first to win five U.S. Opens. Chris, if you would, Tom Watson was reared on the significance of the U.S. Open Championship. Talk, please, about his dad, Ray. And how important for Ray the US Open was, and therefore passing along that to his son.
Yeah, it was a I think it's the Open is it's easily Tom Watson's North Star growing up. It's the entire Watson family's North Star. In fact, Tom wrote a little introduction for the book, a little foreword, and in it he says, my whole life, my Midwestern life growing up consisted of family, faith, and sports. And at the dinner table, Ray was such a traditionalist, as you'll remember, Kelly, way back in the day. I'm talking like back in Max's day. A lot of people referred to the US Open as the National Open. That was the terminology, and that was real old school kind of affectation. And so that's how he grew up. In their household, they didn't call it the US Open, they called it the National Open. And at dinner, the Watson family would be sitting there, and Ray Watson would say, oh, he'd throw out a year. He'd say 1958, and you had to say who won the U.S. Open in 1958, who he beat, and where they played it. And I mean, in my house, occasionally we'd have a spelling bee after dinner, but nothing quite as
Right,
golf
like
centric
that.
as that. And
But
so,
it meant that much to
yes.
his dad, right? It was
Yeah.
huge.
It was everything. And in fact, that became a little bit, I think, anyway, almost counterproductive for Tom. Tom was leading the US Open at Wingfoot after 54 holes and ended up tied for fifth. And he was, in fact, he was winning other majors. In the 1970s and early 80s, he was winning other major titles. But he couldn't win the US Open. And he makes the point in the little foreword that he wrote that sometimes when you cherish something so much, that actually makes it unattainable. And this had become kind of a slippery slope for him. And he kept climbing and slipping and sliding until 82 when he finally got over the top.
It's true. But we had Bob Rotella on a couple of months ago, and we're talking about with Rory McIlroy, and it was right after Rory had won the Players. And I think a lot of that applied, Chris, to Rory at the Masters, of trying so hard to win the Masters. And he credited Dr. Rotella to sort of, free up his mind that it's not a game of perfect. Obviously, a book that Bob wrote, but you have to be able to just play your best and not put so much on that one event, and look how it turned out, right?
And it's interesting because you just have to play golf, really. You have to kind
Yeah.
of forget that you're at Augusta National or forget that you're in the US Open for Watson. But layer two other things on top of this. One is that this particular US Open was at Pebble, which both Watson and Nicklaus have often said is their favorite golf course. And to add just a little extra pressure, it always unfolds. The final always unfolds on Father's Day.
Yes.
And so when you've grown up with your father sort of, hammering home the importance of the National Open, it's being played on your favorite golf course where you believe you may have an edge because you've played it so much. And it's wrapping up on Father's Day. I think that just, for Watson, that just blew all the fuses for most of his career.
Well, for Tom, having gone to Stanford, he played Pebble Beach a lot, right?
Exactly right. And he had a his friend there. There was a starter there named Ray Parga, who he befriended over time, and they had the sort of tacit understanding that if Watson got up early and drove from Palo Alto down to Pebble, Ray would squeeze him in, and he could get in, 18 holes, and then be back in Palo Alto for class before anyone knew he was missing. And so that really benefited Tom. It's clearly, to me, it's one of the reasons that he did win there. It's great familiarity and comfort with the golf course.
I was over with some buddies, played over in the UK back in May, and played one day at Turnberry where Jack and Tom had the epic duel in the sun in 77. And it was, one of the classic showdowns between the two, and separated themselves from really the rest of the field, Chris, as you remember, and Tom won. And Watson, frankly, he won a lot of the, not a lot, but he won a fair amount of those head-to-heads with Jack, right?
Yep.
Building up to 82.
Yeah.
He won Masters. He won Open Championships. He. Not that he had Jack's, the every time, but he had every reason to believe he could beat Jack. He had beaten him.
No doubt about it. He was beating him in majors. He was beating him in tour events. He probably was on paper the best player in the world at that time. But in his own mind, he knew that he had to slay Jack in a US Open because the Open was so important to Watson and his family. The other accomplishments were fantastic, but there was never going to be anything bigger than winning a US Open for Watson. So he had to win an Open if he was going to actually validate his on paper status as the best player in the world. Nothing, no better way to confirm and validate it than to beat Jack. And to do it at Pebble, of course, that they both absolutely loved would just be sort of the icing on the cake. And that's how it all came together for him.
Okay, so let's set the stage, Chris Millard, for the shot. Let's start with Jack. He makes par at 18, and at that, by making par there, as Watson stood on the tee, I believe at 17, they're tied for the lead.
Yeah, let's take a step back though.
Right.
Nicklaus, the great putter, the greatest putter maybe who ever lived, certainly greatest clutch putter who ever lived. Misses a birdie putt on 16, misses a birdie putt on 17, and misses a birdie putt on 18. And if he makes those, even makes two out of three of those, we're probably not even having this conversation. Well, maybe the book would be about Jack winning five US Opens.
Exactly, yeah. But even with all that, once Tom hits the shot at 17 and it misses the green, I know ABC with Jack Whitaker, and I don't know Jack Nicklaus for sure, but ABC almost kind of felt like, well, it's Jack Nicklaus number five is coming around the corner for you, right? Almost like it was a done deal.
Yes, and that's how desperate things look. That the rough for that US Open was so deep, he was so short-sighted. I mean, if you go back and look at the footage, it is stunning to think that he held that shot. So yeah, I think everybody figured as soon as that ball buried in the rough, I think everyone thought at least bogey. That Watson was at least going to make a four, maybe even a five. And there was just nothing he was going to be able to do to catch Jack. In fact, Jastrow told me, and it's in the book, that when he dispatched Jack Whitaker to go down to the scoring tent and interview Jack Nicklaus, there's a quote in the book where Jastrow told me, "We believe that this was the victor's interview. The attitude was, let's go interview the winner."
Right. Meanwhile, Watson hit 2 iron off the tee at 17.
And there
Obviously
was a
pulled.
debate about that too,
Yeah,
Kelly.
what you're right, between he and Bruce Edwards. What was that debate, Chris?
Yeah, so Edwards always believed that w Watson swung his best when he swung hard. So if they took a lesser club, if they took a 3 iron, Watson would swing a little harder and he'd make a better swing. But Watson was a little concerned that if he really did swing that hard, he could get in trouble long left and maybe even be on the beach.
Yes.
So, he kind of he goes with the 2 iron, and seems to be, really it probably was the right club. When you look at where that ball landed, it was, obviously it's left of his target. But if he had hit that ball straight, it probably would have been pin high. But he tugged a little bit, and the wind didn't help him. And there he was, left with this impossible chip with a club that he'd gotten out of David Graham's, garbage can full of discarded wedges.
What's the background on that? When did that happen?
Well, I don't know exactly when, but he was at, these guys, when they go to one another's houses, they're always messing with you. They go to the tool bench and they're looking at grips and heads and shafts and stuff.
Sure.
And as you've been in a lot of players' houses, they have a garbage can or a shelf or racks of, dozens of old clubs. And I'm sure Watson was in the garage and pulled one out and said, "Wow, this looks pretty cool." And David Graham probably said, "Yeah, keep it. I'm not, it's just gathering dust here." It
That's a
worked.
cool. That is so. It did indeed. Okay, it talked a little bit, please, about the interplay between as they get close to the ball, they see the shot. The interplay between Bruce Edwards, Tom's longtime, not just caddy, but great friend, and Tom, and then of course the famous line that Bruce utters. And play that out if you would, please, Chris.
Yeah, so there, as they walk off the tee box, Watson is pretty dejected. He has pretty much said to Edwards something like, that's dead. We're in trouble." And Edwards kind of is trying to buck up his boss a little bit, but with no real basis. He doesn't. No one knows how bad the lie is, and so they're quietly kind of trudging up. The feeling of loss has kind of enveloped them. And as they get a little closer, Edwards can see a little bit of white. He's about 5 steps away and he sees a little white and he goes, "Hey, this is not quite as bad as we thought." And, Watson studies the shot, tries to figure out how he's going to play it. It's the lie may be the quality of the lie may be the most important thing that actually unfolded, maybe in Watson's whole career. If that thing had been down another inch or two, I think it's a bogey and maybe a double. But it was kind of l up on a little tuft of grass. You know how rough can lay down and then the ball kind of laying on. So he did have a chance to get the blade between the ball and the grass, which was huge. And all of a sudden, he's feeling a little bit more confident, a little pep in his step. And as he's kind of calculating the shot, getting ready to step in, Bruce Edwards says to him, "Get it close." And Watson mumbles kind of out the side of his mouth. He goes, "Get it close. Hell, I'm going to hole it." And which, like that is just incredible. And what does he proceed to do? He proceeds to hole it.
Have that confidence in that moment. How every golfer would love to have that feeling of believing you can make that shot, Chris Millard.
Yeah, I honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think that maybe they have the ability to almost block out the impossible part of it and only focus on the possible part. Whereas most of us, we only see the impossible part. And that's what he did. I think he really didn't see the impediment. He only saw what he could do and did it. I wish I could think like that.
I know. I echo that feeling. Okay, so he makes the shot goes in. Jack finds out about it, but he's still got to play 18. He's still got to make par now on 18. And the way you wrote this, he pretty much just played 18 the way you're supposed to play it at that level, right? He didn't let the pressure get to him.
Right. He took a 3 wood instead of a driver and he absolutely hammered it. He had a lot of adrenaline and he absolutely hammered it. He knew right then after he hit the driver, after he hit the 3 wood, and he was in great position. I mean, he hit the 3 wood almost as far as he hits a driver. So it tells you how pumped up he was. He kind of knew right then that he had this thing. And, the nerves kind of dropped off of him and he was in execution mode. And, managed his way in on, a lot of things can go wrong on the 18th hole at Pebble. But I don't think there was any doubt in his mind once he got off the tee safely on 18. There was no doubt in his mind he was going to win.
Things up here with Chris Millard here on Musings on Golf. His new book is The Shot, Watson, Nicklaus, Pebble Beach, and The Chip That Changed Everything. Chris, for 3 years, 95 to 97, you were Jack's director of communications. You wrote a book with Jack having to do with design, architecture. Did Jack ever talk about that 82 U.S. Open with you to any degree?
Well, I did interview him for this particular book.
Yeah.
And I did interview him at length in 1992 when the U.S. Open went back to Pebble. I was at Golf World at the time, and the U.S. Open went back to Pebble in 92. And I did a big feature on Jack and Pebble. And so we talked at length about that. But in just personal day-to-day conversations about Pebble, no, or the 82 Open at Pebble, no, we'd never talked about it. But what's interesting, as you've known Jack for a long time. Jack remembers every putt, every shot, everything ever, and particularly for the tournaments that he's won. But he has this ability to kind of fog over tournaments that maybe he hasn't won. Yeah. So it's not surprising to me when I look back that we haven't talked much about the 82 Open, because why would Jack really want to delve into that? I know that Pebble really is his favorite golf course in the world. He's often said if he had one golf course to play before he were to leave this earth, it would be Pebble.
You know, and that's surprising. I don't know if it's surprising, but it's interesting that he said that consistently, and that it is Pebble over Augusta National, where he obviously had so much success. Why do you think that is? What is the aura? What is it about Pebble Beach, at least for Jack and for Tom?
Well, let's do Jack and Tom later. Let's talk about all humanity. So, you know, people like to be near the water. And I make the point in the book that our bodies are like 96% salt water. And there's something about being near salt water that makes us all feel good. So I think golf courses, even bad golf courses, get extra credit when they're on the water. So I think that's part of it. I think for Jack, the memories of competitive excellence at Pebble are just crazy. We're talking U.S. Amateur, U.S. Open, almost another U.S. Open. And for Watson, we're talking about, youthful trips down from Stanford to Pebble. So in a way, at the 82 Open, they were fighting over the same girl.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they both really loved the place. So that added a whole kind of patina to this 82 Open that maybe other golf tournaments and opens and golf courses just don't have.
Neither one would go on to win a U.S. Open from that point on, right?
Correct. But Watson, well, people forget, the next year at Oakmont, Watson finished second to Larry Nelson.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Well, the same, you know, and when I think of Oakmont, I remember, you know, Tom coming up short at the PGA Championship at 78 when John Mahaffey beat him and Jerry Payton in a playoff, and it was the one major PGA Championship that Tom couldn't secure. Exactly. Like Phil, I think, will be the sixth player all time who won three of the four, but we're not able to win that fourth. And I know that bothered Tom to a degree. Winning the senior PGA championship was significant for him, Chris, yep. but he never won the PGA. I want to focus just for a second on Bruce Edwards, who, you know, we lost through Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, in 2003, I believe. Yep. And just so many lovely words that you put in here about the relationship, how Bruce introduced himself to Tom and the bond that they formed, you know, through the years. But because of Bruce not being able to caddy for Tom at the Masters, and then Tom going overseas and playing, and Alfie was his caddy over at the Open Championship. So this was the only time, right? Bruce Edwards
right.
was on the bag for a major championship. It's almost inconceivable to believe.
Yeah, that to me is one of the kind of interesting little nuggets in the book is, you know, back then, you had to, when you played in the Masters, you had to use a caddy from Augusta. So
yeah.
Watson wins there. He's using a local caddy. And as for his British Open victories, One time he was, Bruce was supposed to go with him and messed up on his passport, couldn't get over there. So Watson goes and he gets Alfie Files and he wins with Alfie Files on the bag. Well, what are you going to do in future opens? You can't very well tell Alfie you're off the bag when you've won. So he goes back over and he wins again with Alfie on the bag.
Right.
And so this series of kind of like passport accidents or player caddy etiquette prevent Edwards from being on the bag for these majors as they're stacking up for Watson.
Yeah.
So when 82 rolls around at Pebble Beach, this is their moment. This is their chance to get a major championship together. And that was Bruce Edwards' only major championship.
And as I mentioned, it went well beyond caddy player relationship, Chris.
Yeah, they were the I think somewhere in the book, I think I say that they became the archetype. If you wanted to identify a successful player caddy relationship, there was no better one than Watson and Edwards. The trust they had with each other, the ability to be wrong, that's something, you know, now that the stakes are so high with purse when prize money in professional golf, being wrong costs a lot of money and it's like a death penalty. Watson and Edwards had so much trust between the two of them that there wasn't really a penalty for being wrong. Having an opinion and, you know, look at that decision on the 17th hole at Pebble. You know, they had a give and take. Bruce wasn't afraid to say what he thought. We're at a point now in professional golf where a lot of caddies do live in a little bit of fear because instead of just a trophy on the line, we're talking about four, you know, what was the last US Open purse? 4.3 million for the winner.
Correct. Yes.
You don't want to give them the wrong club on 17T.
No.
They had an incredible bond that was, it was human, it was friends, it was fraternal, it was family, it was also business on the golf course. But I think it's the great archetype of player caddies in modern golf.
Chris, as we conclude, I like to ask a question about of our guests, you know, who would be three people you'd play a magical round of golf with and so forth. But I'm going to do a little different twist. If you had a chance to play 17 at Pebble Beach with three other individuals, whether living or deceased, and there's three individuals who are at the peak of their careers, and you could stand on that tee, I'm guessing Tom and Jack would be two of those three. Who would be the third? Who would be the third? And then you also get to hit the shot from the same location, from the back tees at 17.
Well, with that part, you just ruined the whole thing because that it was going to be a perfect day until you put the club in my hands. I would say my fourth, me, Tom, and Jack sounds pretty good. And then I would say, how about Chandler Egan? Let's get Chandler Egan out there and get him to talk about what he did to the hole and what he thinks of the hole now. And by the way, he was a hell of a player. So at the top of his game, he was incredible. The funny thing about having Chandler Egan in that group would be this. The place where Watson hit that shot, that famous chip shot, back in 29, when Egan was redoing the golf course for the 29 Amateur, that whole back left kind of semi-circle area back there was all bunkers. And in fact, one of the things Egan did to the golf course was massive bunker scapes all over the place. They were spectacularly beautiful, but the winds in that area wouldn't allow them to keep sand in those bunkers year round. It was just too difficult. So Watson would have, if Chandler Egan's design had survived, Watson would have been in a bunker. And that might have changed the whole thing. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it makes it easier, maybe it makes it harder, but he certainly would have changed the whole thing. So that's why I'd have Chandler Egan there with us.
Great choice. The publisher is Back Nine Press. The book is The Shot, Watson, Nicklaus, Pebble Beach, and the Chip that changed everything. The author is Chris Millard. Hey, Chris, this has been great fun. Folks, get out and buy this book. I would imagine any bookstore, Amazon, et cetera, Chris.
Yep. Amazon probably the best place. Back Nine Press, definitely you can get it on their website, back9press.com, but it's on Amazon as well.
Chris Millard, again, thank you for joining us, and look forward to seeing you down the road.
Thank you, Kelly. Great to see you again.
At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. Well, I hope you enjoyed Chris Millard talking about the shot. I think for a show like ours, it's always fun. It's enjoyable. And I think the listener really gains a lot of knowledge from someone like Chris, who knows the subject so well, in this case, Pebble Beach, the shot itself, and also that relationship between Jack and Tom. And it remains obviously a very strong one today. So we thank Chris Millard very much for that. Let's talk about, in the case of Tom and Jack, both of them were captains of the U.S. Ryder Cup team twice. Let's talk about the current captain of the U.S. Ryder Cup team and the unusual situation that Keegan Bradley finds himself in. It's a good situation for him. Tommy Fleetwood, for whatever reason, has not been able to close the door and win on the PGA Tour, and you found out why on Sunday. Look, when you go against your natural instincts and him changing and putting away that 9-iron that he had in hand from the fairway and going with a wedge, ended up just short of the green, 50 feet away. And then Keegan Bradley, with all the confidence and the USA chants and the massive crowds behind him, just hits a 9-iron to, 6 feet, and the crowd goes absolutely crazy. And you could almost sense what was going to happen with the three-putt for Fleetwood, and then Keegan just rolling his right in to win the Travelers Championship for the second time. He calls it his fifth major. It's, it's very part of his New England roots. It means so much to him. And now, okay, so the PGA of America really went out on a limb, and very much of an out-of-the-box decision when they selected Keegan Bradley to be the 2025 Ryder Cup captain for the United States. And you typically are going to pick somebody older, but in Keegan, they saw something. And what they didn't see necessarily is that he would play so well. And I'm not sure he even saw that. Keegan Bradley, with his win, is now the seventh ranked golfer in the world golf rankings in the world. Now, the way that the Ryder Cup works, when the FedEx Cup playoffs are done, there'll be six automatic point qualifiers for the U.S., and then Keegan will pick six others. Right now, he's number 9 on the Ryder Cup point list. I don't think, to me, there's not even a question whether he makes it on points or has to select himself. I mean, it's a no-brainer. First of all, to win a golf tournament, now he really shows everybody that he can, his game is in top form. I've always also been the one, having worked for the PGA of America for a long time, I understand how the captaincy works, and, having heard all of the stuff about, to be the, play and be the captain and so forth, something that hasn't happened in the Ryder Cup since Arnold Palmer did so in 1963. Just is too much. I can't disagree anymore. First of all, Keegan's picked four vice captains: Jim Furyk, Kevin Kisner, Webb Simpson, and Brent Snedeker to be his vice captains. Collectively, those four guys, along with Keegan, they can figure out pairings. They can figure out which players play well with one another. And quite honestly, when you start to look at the U.S. team after the top six right now, it's a little sketchy. I mean, at the very top, you've got Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele and J.J. Spahn, Russell Henley, Bryson DeChambeau, and Justin Thomas, pretty solid. I do think Brooks Koepka will be picked because he won the PGA Championship at Bethpage Black, where the Ryder Cup will be played. But then you get into Harris English and Maverick McNealy and Ben Griffin and Andrew Novak and Sam Burns and Tom Hoagie. Good players, but my goodness, if you're Keegan Bradley and you're not one of the top six to automatically qualify, you'd almost be doing your team, your country an injustice by not including yourself when those are some of the other options. Nothing personal against those guys, but give me somebody who, working alongside with Phil Mickelson in 2012 at the Ryder Cup of Medina, showed just how strong he can be in Ryder Cup competition, the team competition, and has that experience. And I look back a little bit, and when Arnold was the captain in the playing captain in 63, he went 3-2 in those matches. The U.S. ended up winning 23-9 that year in 63. Ironically, that was played, those matches were played at the Atlanta Athletic Club, which is where Keegan Bradley won the PGA Championship in 2011. So the other context I'll say, I want you to hear Keegan's thoughts on how things, really have changed a bit for him, at least some of his thinking. But keep in mind also the European team that's stacking up right now. You just look at their points. You got Rory McIlroy, you've got Fleetwood, you've got Tyrrell Hatton, you've got Robert McIntyre, Shane Lowry, and Sepp Straka, your top six. Then you've got guys like Åberg and Jon Rahm and Victor Hovland and Justin Rose, Thomas Dietrich. It's a really formidable lineup of European players right now. Again, to me, reinforces why Keegan will need to pick himself to be if he doesn't earn a spot on the team. Let's hear what Keegan has to say about maybe how his approach has changed from being a strictly a captain, possibly being a playing captain in 3 months at Bethpage Black.
When they called me and told me, I'm thinking, I really want to be on the team. And he first thing he said was, "We want you to be the first playing captain since Arnold Palmer," which is a heavy burden. But my head was spinning. I didn't know what they were talking about, but they knew that that was a possibility and that we would have things in place for that. But I'm always trying to be the best that I can be, and I feel like I'm playing the best golf of my career right now. And, a year ago, I don't know if I would have thought I'd be seventh in the world, but I certainly thought I'd be, contending in tournaments.
If I'm Keegan Bradley, I'm not going to reveal everything at this point. You can't tip your hand, but I would think that he will be playing. I think the PGA of America will be thrilled with that. It will give even more juice, if you will, to the Ryder Cup for 2025. The only thing I would add to this is the U.S. really needs to win this Ryder Cup. I mean, they really didn't play very well in Rome 2 years ago. It was embarrassing on a lot of fronts with guys not wearing hats and so forth and so on, the Patrick Cantlays of the world. At home with a massive crowd, support of crazy New Yorkers behind them, this is why you have Keegan Bradley to go along with the frenzy that will be taking place over those 3 days on Long Island. That this is exactly why he needs to be a player, not a cheerleader. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with that. A lot will take place, and I have a good feeling that we're going to be talking to Keegan here on Musings on Golf sometime over the next few months before the matches get going at Bethpage Black. Again, thanks to Chris Millard. Really enjoyed the interview with him, having to do with the shot. And encourage you all to buy that book, Keegan Bradley. Let's get that Ryder Cup captaincy as a player going. Bob Bupka, we miss you. Look forward to seeing you soon. And to all of you, thank you again for joining us here on Musings on Golf.